Journalist Paul Eddy spent the last few years researching the Colombian cocaine cartel and the pipeline to Miami. He concludes that the Reagan administration may have fought the wrong war in Latin America. While it obsessively focused on stopping the spread of communism, drug traffickers were subverting much of Latin America. Paul Eddy says that the White House rhetoric about the war on drugs was never matched by sufficient funds. Eddy is the co-author of The Cocaine Wars. He began his cocaine research as part of the investigative insight team of the Sunday Times of London. He was the team's editor for 4 years. Since 1985, he and his two co-authors have lived in Miami, and they traveled through Central and South America researching the cocaine wars. I spoke to him from station KQED in San Francisco. I asked Paul Eddy to explain his statement that perhaps the United States fought the wrong war, fighting communism instead of drugs.
Well, it's not necessarily the wrong war, but the problem is the obsession that particularly this administration, but also to a degree Congress, has had with the fight against the threat of communism in Latin America has gone to such an extent that I think they've often ignored the very real threat posed by drug traffickers. Because whilst the communists, at least so far, are still some distance away, the drug traffickers are in this country. They are poisoning this country's blood system.
To what extent do you think Latin America is now controlled by drug traffickers?
I think there are various countries that are in appalling trouble. Colombia, I think, has been brought almost to its knees by traffickers. And there are large areas of that country where the traffickers have more respect, more power, more authority, and are certainly more feared than the central government in Bogota. I have a lot of sympathy for that government. I think that there are people within it, both elected and officials, who have tried extremely hard to stand up against trafficking, with precious little result and often at appalling risk to themselves. The Colombians say, and I think with some justice, that this war on drugs in their country is not a war of words, and thousands of people have been killed.
Let's talk about the Colombia cartel and what the United States is up against. First of all, you said that the cartel established control over the city and over authorities through fear. Explain what some of their tactics have been in manipulating.
Well, quite often the manipulation is based on bribery rather than fear. They will buy people in the sense that they provide employment, they provide some form of social welfare, they will pay money to corrupt officials. But those they can't coerce and bribe, they will intimidate by threatening them. And if those threats are ignored and those people continue to stand up against them, then by very violent action, often kidnapping, very often assassination. They've killed one justice minister, one attorney general, half the justices of the Supreme Court, 50 or 60 other judges, senior police officers, army officers. There's a saying in Colombia, which is you can be rich or you can be dead. And the problem we have in dealing with these people is that they mean it. They don't make empty threats. If you stand in their way, if you seriously threaten them, they will eliminate you.
So are you suggesting that the part of the judiciary system and the government that isn't already bought by the drug traffickers is totally intimidated by them?
Yes, and it's also overwhelmed. The average investigative magistrate in Colombia has 3,000 to 5,000 unsolved homicides on his docket, and no possibility of dealing with a fraction of those. And by the time people have come to trial, if indeed they do come to trial, it's 3 or 4 years down the track. The likelihood of witnesses turning up is almost zero. The Colombian justice system is a joke, and that's not my expression. It's a quotation from people who work within it.
Let's talk about the origins of the Colombia cartel. The biggest people within the cartel have been the Ochoa family.
Yes.
Who are they, and how do they get started in the drug business?
The Ochoas are a family of landowners and ranchers, and they breed horses. And in the post-Vietnam period in the United States, among those who witnessed the growing tolerance for drugs in this country, as well as the growing demand, was Jorge Ochoa. Jorge is the middle son. There are three sons. He's now aged 39. And he saw that there was an enormous and growing market for illegal drugs in this country. Simultaneously, in Brazil, because of, first of all, the decline in tin prices, and secondly, the collapse of the cotton price, in Bolivia, what they essentially did was to substitute cotton with coca, a mass planting operation that took place in 1976. And within 2 or 3 years of that, we saw an enormous increase in supplies of coca, which is what cocaine is made of. And Ochoa was among those who realized that, on the one hand, there was this enormous and growing market, on the other hand, enormous and growing supply. And he went back to Colombia and, among others, decided to put the two together. Later on, the importance of Ochoa's role is that he, among others, but he's the principal one, decided that what had been rival and disparate gangs of traffickers, more often than not fighting each other, that they had common cause and common interest, and that it would be better served if they were to cooperate, to collaborate. And he and a man called Pablo Escobar, in around about 1981, formed in the city of Medellin, Colombia's second biggest city from where they both come, formed what they called Medellin and Company, which has now become known to us as the Medellin Cartel, certainly the most powerful and certainly the most influential trafficking organization that exists today. Into their partnership, they later took a man called Gonzalo Rodriguez Gacha from Bogota. And between them, these three, I like to refer to them as a sort of Boeing aircraft corporation of the drug world, in the sense that as Boeing employs hundreds, if not thousands, of subcontractors to make the bits and pieces that go into one of their airplanes, so the cartel employ hundreds, if not thousands, of people who get involved in various stages of the process of making and distributing cocaine. And they are known in their own country as the holders of the quota. These are the three men who decide which groups get how much business, and therefore they are extremely powerful.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Paul Eddy, who's the co-author of the new book, The Cocaine Wars. Now, once these individuals banded together and formed a cartel, how did it change the drug trade in Colombia? You describe it as almost going from these little kitchen-sized operations to these huge complexes manufacturing cocaine out of coca.
Yes, I mean, it became essentially much more sophisticated. The cartel is an integrated, vertically organized, highly sophisticated, ruthless corporation. And one of the best examples of that we've seen was their construction of a clandestine laboratory in a remote area of Colombia, which they called Tranquilandia. It was on an island 6.5 square miles and contained the most sophisticated cocaine production laboratory, sleeping quarters, all the accoutrements that they needed. It was guarded by guerrillas, with whom the cartel has a loose affiliation, and was set up with all kinds of escape routes and things like that. And when Tranquilandia was eventually raided by the police, they found among an enormous amount of equipment some 14 tons of cocaine. Now, 14 tons is what we used to estimate to be the entire world annual production. And here in this one complex, there was 14 tons, and it was pushed into the river by the authorities. And my point is that there was so much cocaine available by then, so much of it was reaching the United States, that in America we didn't even notice. Nothing happened to the street price of cocaine.
This might be asking for the real obvious, but how did Miami become the American end of the cocaine pipeline?
Two reasons. Geographic, obviously, one of them, because it faces Colombia. It's the front door of America. It's the most convenient entry point from that part of the world. I think, secondly, because South Florida, and particularly Miami, has a very large Hispanic population. And I think the cartel feel more comfortable dealing with Hispanics rather than gringos, who they don't altogether trust.
Now, I want to ask you about the Drug Enforcement Agency's attempts to deal with the Colombian cartel. But first, I want to ask you about a couple of other of the main characters in this drug pipeline story. Let me ask you about Luis Garcia, who's also known as Kojak, because he shaves his head and looks slightly like Telly Savalas. Now, you say that he introduced the drug trade to the Bahamas.
I'm not sure he introduced it, but he perfected it. He went out and bought a nation. Kojak was 47 years old when he became a smuggler, and prior to that he led a fairly respectable life, raised his children, paid his taxes, that kind of thing. But at 47 he saw in Miami the type of people who were getting involved in the smuggling business, that's bringing it in from transshipment points into the United States, principally Florida. And he thought if these guys could do it, he could do it, and probably a great deal better. And Kojak, realizing that the Bahamas was only 50 miles off the coast, went over there and bought everybody he needed to. There was almost nobody he didn't or wouldn't pay. He had the head of the Bahamian drug strike force on his payroll, so that whenever this man went out to conduct a raid, he would first of all call Kojak to tell him he was coming. And as a result of this, Kojak was able to buy himself virtual immunity. He operated from several Bahamian islands. For 4 years, he brought drugs into the United States like a shuttle service. He didn't lose one load, not one of his people was arrested. He didn't kill anybody, and neither were any of his people killed. He was never indicted nor prosecuted. Indeed, he wasn't even questioned. And at the end of 4 years, he was able to go to the Drug Enforcement Administration, who knew well of him. I mean, I knew a lot about him, and tell them that he was retiring and they didn't have to bother about him anymore. They explained it wasn't quite as easy as that, and Kojak was eventually persuaded to work with the DEA and to help them in some undercover operations. He was essentially our guide to this world. He took us around, showed us how it worked, introduced us to the people involved in it, and without him we certainly wouldn't have got anywhere as near as close as we did to the trafficking industry.
What was it like traveling around with him?
Great fun. Occasionally scary. I remember particularly when a contract was placed on his life and the DEA wanted him to get out of town, and he refused to leave because he had a dinner date with me. I
kind of puts you on the spot, doesn't it?
I did my best to persuade him that, you know, we can have dinner any day, let's go. But he wouldn't. He stayed, and he insisted after dinner and going to his own house and sleeping in his own bed, and I went with him. And it was a scene sort of out of Miami Vice. I had no idea what I was doing, but fortunately nothing happened. He was a remarkable man. I don't admire for one second what he did, but I did admire him. He was very brave, very honest in a strange way. He introduced to the Bahamas what he calls true communism, which is, if I make a buck, you make a buck. And that was kind of his philosophy in life. He made millions upon millions of dollars, but he gave away millions upon millions of dollars.
Why do you think he retired?
He retired principally because he became bored with the company he was obliged to keep. By and large, small-time drug traffickers, the people who bring the stuff in and who then distributed it, are not very interesting people. They don't have a lot of conversation, and far too many of them use the stuff, which limits even further their conversation. But secondly, and I think more seriously, he saw the damage that it was doing to his family, members of his family who were involved in his business. Either their greed for money was becoming so great, or, unfortunately, some of them were using the product. And he had a cousin who was violently murdered, another one who was heading that way, and a couple who were addicted. And I think he came to regret it. He was one of these people who thought marijuana was, you know, nothing very serious, and if people wanted to smoke it, that was fine. And he didn't have a great moral standpoint about cocaine, but as he saw the damage that cocaine was doing, he became, I think his view changed a lot, and I think at the end he was quite sorry about what he'd done and went out of his way to try and put it right by helping the DEA.
Well, now, what's his status now?
Unfortunately, he died. He died of a heart attack. Just as this book was coming to an end, we were trying to persuade the wife of Carlos Lader, perhaps the most notorious trafficker so far convicted in the United States. We were trying to persuade his wife to talk to us, and she'd agreed to do so, and Kojak went to New York to collect her for us and unfortunately suffered a heart attack and died.
So when you used to travel with him, you called him Kojak?
No, he didn't like being called Kojak, except by the people he used to work with.
Right.
No, I always called him Lewis.
I found this very interesting that several of the people who were or are very big in cocaine trafficking had counterparts in the film and television world and used their counterparts' names. You know, there was Kojak, there's Little Clint, named
yeah.
after Clint Eastwood. I find that kind of amusing, I think.
Well, you know, it's a very lonely life being a drug trafficker, because you can't very well go home and say, "Had a bad day on the drug boat today, dear." You can't talk to your neighbours very much about it. And so they do end up talking to each other a lot. And because they are also paranoid, First of all, they walk around, they're always armed. And secondly, they talk in these sort of strange elliptical language, so that just in case anybody's overhearing it, it doesn't make any sense. And they call each other by nicknames. And some of them have a bewildering variety of nicknames. I know people who have sort of 14 or 15 different names, and you never know what to call them, because you're not sure what name they're using today.
Let me just ask you briefly what Kojak's connection was to the Colombian cartel. Kojak, again, having bought off a Bahamian island to use that as a point of operation.
Kojak started by smuggling marijuana from Colombia, graduated eventually to smuggling cocaine, and just shortly before his retirement brought in for the Medellin cartel what was then probably the largest single shipment of cocaine. By today's standards, it was tiny, but in those days, 350 kilos, which is what he brought in, was quite a lot. And he was a subcontractor. He was paid per pound or per kilo, or whatever it was he brought in, and he then paid his people according to a scale of fees and netted the profit. And the profit, for example, on the last load he brought in for the cartel was $1.8 million.
Okay, I want to talk with you about the war against drugs that's been waged by the Reagan administration, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is journalist Paul Eddy, co-author of the new book, The Cocaine Wars, which is about the cocaine trafficking pipeline from Colombia to Miami. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. British journalist Paul Eddy is my guest, author of the new book, The Cocaine Wars. Now, the Reagan administration has declared a war on drugs, but you think that they haven't fought that war very well. Let's look at some of the strategies that have been used in the United States and see why you think that they failed. One of the strategies was to try to get Peru and Bolivia to stop growing coca, thinking there would be no raw material for Colombia to manufacture cocaine from and that would dry up cocaine. Why do you think that that was ill-advised, that was doomed to fail?
Well, the people of the Andes have been growing coca since 2000 BC. It's part of their culture. It's part of their religion. It's a good luck charm. The Incas regarded it as divine. They smoke it. They drink it in tea. They chew it. And frankly, they don't take very kindly to foreigners coming along, telling them that the oldest known stimulant to man, which is what coca is something they shouldn't grow. And why don't they grow something healthy, you know, like tobacco? So first of all, you have that great resistance to that. Now, of course, they grow vastly more than they need for domestic consumption. And the reason they do that is quite straightforward. You can find farmers in parts of the Chaper Valley and elsewhere in those regions where the entire family's total income for the year might, if they are lucky, be $200. Now, by growing just enough coca to make 1 kilo of cocaine, they can make $500. They can almost treble their income, just growing a little bit more of what they grow anyway. And when you think of the number of people who are doing this, any idea that any government, certainly of a government like Bolivia or Peru, can go out there and somehow stop these people doing that is just ludicrous.
Well, the Reagan administration knows, I think, a good deal now of who the kingpins are in the cocaine pipeline, who the main traffickers are. What are some of the obstacles they're up against in actually getting these guys?
Well, first of all, locating them. George Ochoa has been located twice, once in Spain where he was arrested, and once in Colombia. Now, what happened in Spain was that the United States spent almost 2 years trying to get him extradited to this country and failed. The reason they failed is because most of the evidence against him that was specifically presented to the Spanish courts also concerned Nicaragua, the American accusation being that the Sandinista government was involved in drug trafficking to the United States. And the Spanish have a very different view about Nicaragua to the United States, and frankly thought that this was all cooked up, and that what the United States was doing was trying to bash the Sandinistas rather than extradite a drug trafficker. And because of that Nicaraguan factor, Ochoa was allowed to go not to the United States but to Colombia, where, to nobody's surprise, he was released almost immediately. Now, when he was arrested in Colombia at the end of last year, the United States believed that there was a possibility that the Colombians would extradite him to the United States. That seemed to me a forlorn hope from day one, and indeed what happened was that eventually his two brothers, George's two brothers, and Pablo Escobar, his partner, went and had a word with a judge in Medellin. I do not know what passed between them, but I do know the result, which was the judge ordered Ochoa's release from prison. There's a great hoo-ha in Colombia, the government launched inquiries and all this kind of thing, but by that time Ochoa is gone. And the influence of the cartel is now so widespread, they are involved in so many countries, that he has so many safe havens. I think it's extremely difficult to find him, even if we did. And let me say that the United States government has a $500,000 reward on the table for the arrest of George Ochoa. If that were to happen, I think it would rather be like arresting Henry Ford and hoping that would bring an end to automobile accidents. It's too late. There is now beneath Ochoa and beneath Escobar a whole generation of people who have been brought up with the experience that the cartel has given them, who are actually, I suspect, waiting for Ochoa to move over, and indeed some of them even maybe trying to nudge him aside.
Were you surprised to find out about about an ally like Noriega of Panama being involved in drug trafficking himself?
No, I wasn't. And I don't believe that anybody who's looked at this topic since 1983 or 1984 could have been surprised. In fact, I think you'd have to have been both blind and deaf not to know there were serious, consistent and persistent allegations that Noriega was benefiting from drug trafficking and facilitating it. My surprise was that they really believed that he was an enemy against communism, that he was this guy who was, you know, helping us stop the threat from Cuba and Nicaragua, whereas in fact, as we now know, he was dealing with both sides all along. The guy is a straightforward drug trafficker, has been for a long time. He's not the only one. He's not alone by any means.
What do you think the Reagan administration should do to effectively wage war on cocaine?
I don't come here with any simple answers, I'm afraid. And all the answers that I've heard debated are either impossible or on their own they're not going to work. I mean, legalization, I don't think, stands a chance of being approved, either politically or in public opinion. Interdiction, this great myth that we can somehow seal our borders and stop the stuff coming in, is just silly. It doesn't work. It seems to me the only way to do it is to somehow try and reduce demand. And that is the one area where I see a few glimmers of hope. There are surveys showing that, for example, the class of 87 high school students were less inclined to experiment with cocaine than the class of 86 or 85 or 84. And if that trend might be maintained through drug education and the Just Say No campaigns, all this kind of thing, then eventually we might see the demand for cocaine decline. What bothers me about these surveys is that their optimism ignores the fact that the people who are now most at risk from the epidemic of cocaine are those who use crack cocaine, and they tend to be the people who've dropped out of high school anyway. Crack cocaine, because it's available in smaller units and therefore at a price which more people can afford, at least initially, has crossed the borders in our society. It's gone down into those communities where they're not using drugs to enhance their lives. They're using drugs because they don't have a life, they don't have jobs, they don't have hope.
What are you going to be watching for as this story continues?
I think you will see increasing violence from crime associated with the use of crack cocaine. There's only two ways that most people can afford to support a crack habit once they acquire it. One is by becoming dealers themselves, which means they go out seeking new customers, therefore spreading it. The second way is through crime, through robberies, muggings, breakings, and that kind of thing. We're also beginning to see turf battles in ghettos as people fight for street corners where the crack can be sold. And what has alarmed me as I've been traveling around the country this month is we're not just talking about Miami, New York, and Washington, D.C., and San Francisco. We're now talking about relatively small, quiet places that we thought were immune from this kind of thing. St. Paul, Minnesota, for example, That's an appalling crack problem that has led to violence, to young people being killed. In St. Paul a couple of weeks ago, there were men, crack dealers, driving through the ghetto who were encouraging their children as to the possibilities of this trade by throwing money out of the car windows. We see it in Arlington, Virginia. They're having to treble the size of their jail because of drug-related crime. More than half of the murders committed in America last year were drug-related. That's going to build, and I think people are very frightened about that.
We only have a minute left, but I'm curious about how you got onto this story, since you're a British journalist and it's really such an American story.
Well, one of my co-authors is Colombian, and he'd seen and was living in Colombia, and he'd seen the growing power of the cartel. I'd been to the Bahamas to do an investigation there and saw what was happening in that society and how corrupt it had become. And it just seemed so obvious that all of this was bound to have an impact, that what was happening elsewhere, this enormous increase in supply and this utter ruthlessness of this organization, must be impacting on America. And so we decided to come and see for ourselves.
You've been living in Miami. Will you continue to live there now that your book is completed?
No. No, I haven't left Miami.
You've left it, and you're going back to England?
Eventually.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Paul Eddy. His new book is titled The Cocaine Wars. It's published by Norton. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.